Good morning.
We'll wait for this class to come in.
Marcia?
I think we have students from Valley Christian School. Would they stand if they're here? They are here. Good. Thank you for coming. You may be seated. Do we have our students from Faith Christian School? Ah, they're coming. All right. This is a grand entrance. The students will come. All right. With all respect, if you make the students, it'll be better than the noise when they arrive. Check with Kevin. Please. Thank you. Pardon me? All right, let's just begin. Faith Christian School will arrive. The students are here with a program cleverly entitled Court with Class. Students from high schools around the state are invited to join us for an oral argument. If the students accept the invitation, they are sent materials relating to the case and might engage in some activities that revolve around the case. Then, when the students arrive, not only do they hear the oral argument, but at noon after our second case, the students will meet with a justice who has been assigned for that day. And the students will discuss with the justice the procedures of the court, not the substantive issues of this case. And everyone is invited to join the students to hear that and participate in that discussion. So let me introduce the court to you all. Starting on my far left is Justice Michael Gableman. Seated next to him is Justice Patience Rogensack. The class will meet with Justice Rogensack. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To her right, Justice David Prosser. And on the far right, Justice Annette Ziegler. With those introductions made, I'm going to call the first case, which is Denise Brunton versus Nouvelle Credit Corporation. Arguing on behalf of Nouvelle Credit Corporation is Ethan Miller. Counsel?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Ethan Miller, and it is my distinct honor to appear before you today, arguing on behalf of the petitioner, Nouvelle Credit Corporation. I will be presenting the initial portion of our argument. Attorney Walter Stewart, who also appears on behalf of the petitioner today, will be handling our 5-minute rebuttal. This case arises out of a consumer credit transaction and is governed by the Wisconsin Consumer Act. The sole issue before the court today is when is a defendant deemed to have waived improper venue under Section 421.401, the Wisconsin Consumer Act's venue provision. The circuit court dismissed this case, stating that pursuant to the holding of Kett, it lacked jurisdiction to do anything else. In a published decision, the Court of Appeals reversed the circuit court, determining that petitioner had appeared and waived its objection to improper venue by its active participation in the litigation. The Court of Appeals went on to say that it need not decide precisely when such waiver occurred. The Court of Appeals' decision in this case should be reversed for four reasons. The first is that the decision ignores the legislative intent of the Wisconsin Consumer Act's venue statute. The second is that the decision is contrary to the plain language of the statute. Third, the decision fails to recognize the jurisdictional nature of the statute. And fourth, the decision abrogates this court's holding in NICRA.
Counsel, has the statute of limitations run?
On plaintiff's claim?
Yeah.
Yes, Your Honor.
So, I'm not saying this is what you did in this case, but next case somebody could do it and sit and wait until the statute runs, then claim the wrong venue, and then the plaintiff has no recourse. Is that right? You're going to claim the statute of limitations if they sue again in Rock County.
You are correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Proceed.
But I think the important point here is that the what I hear you alluding to is game playing or sandbagging on the part of a defendant. I think the important point is that the legislature intended to limit game playing by preventing plaintiffs from filing in the wrong county.
Who's the plaintiff ordinarily in this consumer credit action?
I would argue more often than not a consumer is going to be, or excuse me, the creditor is going to be the plaintiff and a consumer is going to be the defendant.
That's what I thought. And the whole point of the statute is to have the corporation, the creditor, sue where the consumer finds it easy to be, namely his home county, and therefore easier to defend there.
I think that was one of the legislature's stated purposes,
right.
But the legislature also intended for a fair and balanced playing field, and specifically did not use the word or differentiate between a consumer defendant and a creditor defendant in the venue statute.
You know when the statute of limitations ran out?
In this case? It's a one-year statute of limitations. The alleged prohibited practices occurred, I believe, in November and December of 2006. So the statute of limitations would have tolled by the end of December 2007.
And when did you put in your defense?
We filed our answer in February of 2006.
To say that the venue was bad.
We filed our motion for summary judgment based on the venue defect in February of 2007 before the trial court's deadline for dispositive motions. Again,
Miller, let me follow up what some of my colleagues have been asking, but take it a little further. I had 19 years as a trial court judge here in Wisconsin. And I look at this case, and I look at it in the light of the time spent by the court, the time spent by counsel, and if we adopt your approach, if we say any time you can bring such a motion, it seems to me that it results in many instances in a waste of the circuit court's time. How do you respond to that?
Well, Your Honor, I think the answer is that the legislature, again, put the onus on the plaintiff to file in the right county. There is no waste of judicial economy if plaintiffs are filing, whether they're the creditor or the consumer, are filing in the correct county of venue.
Well, shouldn't there be some obligation to, at some reasonable period of time, bring the motion rather than going through a year with apparently a notice of appearance, an answer, discovery, including a number of depositions, court time being utilized for scheduling, and then, and only then, bringing this motion before the court?
Well, I would make two comments, Your Honor. One is that we brought our motion before the deadline for dispositive motions. If a circuit court is concerned about this issue, it can set an earlier deadline for dispositive motions. The second point is that while the statute no longer, when we look at the legislative history later, it shows that the previous incarnation of the statute required circuit courts to raise the issue of venue. The plain language of the statute as it exists today no longer requires circuit courts to raise the issue, but it does not prevent circuit courts from raising the issue. Again, if the circuit court judge were concerned about venue and didn't want to waste time, there's nothing preventing the circuit court from raising it sua sponte.
Counsel, following up on what Justice Crooks just said, I'm worried about gamesmanship and how people can try to receive some reading from the trial court as to whether they think the trial court's favorable to them or not. I mean, for example, in a substitution of judge case, you can't bring motions, see how the judge is deciding them, and then decide to substitute, right? There's some logic behind that because, you know, once a judge has a case, you let the judge keep it. And what I'm hearing you say is the judge has the onus, maybe, of bringing a motion for a party in a case. And part of that, I mean, that troubles me, your answer to Justice Crooks, just so you know.
Can I clarify, Justice Stewart?
You can in a moment. And then the other part of that is, you know, once you go down a path and you have motions and the court's deciding a case and you're kind of proceeding down there, why shouldn't that be deemed to be a waiver? Why shouldn't that be the end of the analysis?
The first half of your question, Your Honor, I wasn't implying that the onus still exists on circuit courts to raise the issue sua sponte. I was commenting on the former incarnation of the venue statute governing consumer credit transactions, which specifically did say, now that circuit courts had the burden to raise the issue if neither of the parties did. That language was deleted and no longer exists in the current statute. So I'm not suggesting that the onus still exists for the circuit court to raise the issue. I'm just suggesting that there's nothing preventing a circuit court from raising the issue if it has concerns about judicial economy. Now, the second part of your question was why not find an imputed waiver or passive waiver, as we call it in our briefs. The answer is because the legislature made the issue jurisdictional. Ket is clear. Any judgment other than a judgment of dismissal is invalid when entered unless the defendant appears and waives, unless there's some affirmative act by the defendant.
Counselor, don't we really have a question of competence, not jurisdiction, with this statute? We have a gazillion cases which say that our jurisdiction arises under the Constitution. So it doesn't matter the words that the legislature uses. The legislature doesn't alter what the Constitution gives us in regard to subject matter jurisdiction. And if, in fact, this is subject matter jurisdiction, we have a number of cases that say it's never waivable. So isn't this really a case about competence, and why shouldn't we look at it in that regard?
I think you're absolutely correct, Justice Rosenzweig. It's a competency jurisdiction question. Subject matter jurisdiction is unwaivable, and clearly the statute contemplates a waiver. The question is whether the waiver needs to be expressed or whether it can be an imputed or passive waiver. I don't think the term or the label really matters here. The point is, whether we call it jurisdiction, competency jurisdiction, it's clearly not subject matter jurisdiction because that's unwaivable. The point is, this statutory requirement is central to the legislative scheme, is central to the statute, and failure to comply with that leaves the court without the ability, whether it's called competency or competency jurisdiction, to do anything but dismiss.
Mr. Miller, it seems as though the petitioner places great substantive weight on the Ket case application to the present case. Is Ket really a fair comparison to what happened here? Because in Ket, my recollection is they were default judgments. And the consumer defendants they didn't waive because they didn't appear.
You're absolutely correct, Your Honor. The Ket case dealt with default judgments, default replevin judgments, that were filed in the wrong county. But the analysis of Ket is dispositive in this case. That's our position. This court noted in Ket, while it did not consider the waiver, it relied on 5 points in reaching its conclusion. The first of which was that the legislature has expressly declared that a defect in venue is jurisdictional. Nothing but a judgment of dismissal is permissible when venue is improper and the customer has failed to appear and waive the defect. The point is that the infirmity exists at the point of filing, not when it's raised by the defendant. The second point that this court relied on, Kett, is that the different treatment of improper venue in consumer versus consumer credit transactions shows the deliberate legislative intent to protect consumers using credit. This protection is negated by the Court of Appeals decision here. The third point from Kett is that the legislative history shows the intent of the statute to be jurisdictional in nature. Section 421.401 is separate and distinct from the general venue statutes, 80150 and 80151. The fourth point from Kett is that an interpretation that a jurisdictional defect renders a judgment invalid advances the legislative goal that actions be brought in a county convenient for the consumer. As we've stated, one of the stated purposes of the Wisconsin Consumer Act in Section 421.102 is to protect consumers. However, another stated purpose is to permit and encourage fair and balanced practices for both consumers and creditors. This is reflected by the legislature's decision not to differentiate between consumer and creditor defendants under the venue statute.
Counsel, we've got an issue of statutory interpretation, right?
Yes.
Let's accept that wrong venue is jurisdictional. You got to dismiss, and that's what the statute says. But it says if you appear and waive the venue issue, it's gone, right?
It requires the circuit court to dismiss unless the defendant appears and waives.
Okay. So what does the word appear mean?
To appear before the circuit court.
Okay. Did you appear?
We did. We don't allege or argue that
okay.
We did not.
All right. So then they get to the question of waive. Now, the concept of waiver in the law has at least two different meanings. One is you consciously, intentionally, voluntarily forego the issue, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is your argument that you did not consciously, intentionally, and voluntarily forego this issue of objecting to the venue?
That is safe to say, Your Honor. We never expressly waived the
venue.
I
didn't say expressly. I said there's no express in the statute. Word express is not there, right?
Yes.
I know you add it in your brief, but it's not there. So waiver can mean a conscious, intentional, voluntary decision not to object, or not to take an affirmative step of objecting, right?
Yes, and it's our position that we did not waive.
You did not consciously, intentionally. The second meaning, or a second meaning, and there may be more, but you find it in these cases, is that waiver means you forfeit. That if you don't do something timely, it is gone. And you'll see a number of appeals cases where you didn't make the objection timely at the trial court, it is gone. You have forfeited. It doesn't matter that you didn't know it. It doesn't matter that you didn't intend to do it. So the word waiver, and our court cases use the word waiver to mean sometimes intentional and voluntary and consciously, and the other times meaning forfeit. So I'm not so sure the legislature makes a distinction between those two uses of the word waiver. So why isn't it that you forfeited this? You forfeited the defense because you didn't do it in a timely manner.
For a couple of reasons, Your Honor. One, I believe the legislature... We take the position that the legislature afforded this special protection to consumer defendants, but it applies to all defendants for a reason, to protect consumers. The risk, if you allow a passive waiver, is that, as you commented before, consumers, who more often than not are going to be the defendants, who may very well be appearing pro se, are going to unknowingly waive the special protection afforded by the legislature. The second point that I would make is...
I understand that, but we treat people who appear by themselves in the same manner as we treat lawyers. I mean, that's a basic tenet of the statutes and of the court's cases.
Yes, Your Honor. But the jurisdictional nature of the defect, again, cannot be waived other than by an express waiver. To allow otherwise would allow the circuit court to confer jurisdiction upon itself. If the circuit court could find waiver by inaction, it would defeat the legislature's purpose, the structure of the statute. Additionally, the legislative history reinforces the affirmative waiver requirement. Originally, venue under the Wisconsin Consumer Act was governed by two different statutes. Consumer transactions were governed by Section 421.401, but venue in consumer credit transactions was governed by Section 425.501. Section 421.401 was created by 1983 WIS Act 228, which also recreated the general venue statutes, 80150 and 80151. 11 days later, the legislature enacted 1983 WIS Act 389, which created 425.501. The two statutes were subsequently combined by 1987 WIS Act 208 to form Section 421.401 as it exists today. The language of Section 425.501, the original incarnation of the venue provision for consumer credit transactions, is significant.
Counselor, is there any limit to how far you could go in litigating the matter before you raised the objection to improper venue? From what I understand you're saying is, well, you did it within the scheduling order, fine, but is there any statutory limit on how far you can go?
We read the statute to as this court did in Kett, that any order but a judgment of dismissal is invalid when entered unless the defendant appears and waives. We're arguing that the waiver needs to be affirmative or express. So without that waiver, I think the answer to your question is no.
No. So you could have run this case if you had a judge that didn't give you a scheduling order right away. You could have run the case for 3 years before you objected to venue, right?
Conceivably, yes. And
that's
consistent.
You think the legislature meant that? You really think the legislature meant the waiver to have to take so long? Does that make sense to you?
I do, and the legislative history bears that out.
How is that?
Well, again, the original incarnation of the venue provision for consumer credit transactions, first important to note that it also made it a jurisdictional issue. But additionally, Section 425.501 contained a timing element and placed the onus on the circuit court, as I mentioned earlier with Justice Ziegler, placed the onus on the circuit court to take action sua sponte if neither
of the parties... Placed the onus, or did it say it may do it in its own motion?
No, it says shall. Okay. The court shall, and I quote, Your Honor, the court shall, on motion of a party or on its own motion...
Okay, on its own. So it doesn't say that the court has to make a motion. It says that the court may make a motion, and if it does it sua sponte, then it shall dismiss. That's where the shall is.
I respectfully disagree, Your Honor. I think the statute says the court shall, on motion of a party or on its own motion. I think the court may raise it on its own motion only if, or the court is required to raise it on its own motion if it's not raised by one of the parties.
Mr. Miller, I don't understand the relevance of the scheduling order within the context of your argument. You seem quite clear on that the court lacked jurisdiction. Well, whether we say jurisdiction, I think the court always has subject matter jurisdiction, but whether it has competency in this matter is a different question. I think what you're really arguing is it lacked competency to hear the case. Now, if there was a scheduling order and a party in your position, postured in your position, whether it was the consumer or whether it was the creditor, what difference would it make if it disregarded the scheduling order for dispositive motions and waited until the end of trial? You know, this matter was scheduled for a 2 to 4 day trial. What would have happened if you had brought your motion at the close of evidence of the trial? The matter was still before the circuit court. From what I can infer from your briefs and your argument, the court would have had to have recognized
Your Honor. Here, obviously, we did bring our objection before the motion, the deadline.
But it doesn't really matter, according to your argument.
I don't think it would matter in the ultimate result of the case. And that's consistent with this court's holding in Nikrut, which examined competency objections and specifically rejected a pleading waiver rule and instead said that a common law waiver rule applies so that, or such that an objection to competency is waived if not brought before the circuit court.
I guess I wonder how your argument and your position is in conformity. I look at section 801.50 of the Wisconsin statutes, and I know you say, well, that's the general venue statute and is therefore inapplicable. But if I look at subsection 5 small m of that statute, it tells us that venue of an action arising from a consumer credit transaction, which this would have been or is, as defined in the section, shall be in any county specified in section 421.401, which in this instance would have been Rock County. Everybody seems to agree to that, right?
Correct.
And then I look at section 801.51 right after that, challenges to improper venue, and the introductory sentence says, any party may challenge venue on the grounds of noncompliance with section 801.50. Now, here's some key language that I'm going to direct your attention to and ask you to respond to. Or any other statute designating proper venue by filing a motion for change of venue at or before the time the party serves his or her first motion or responsive pleading in the action. Now, why would that not relate back to section 421.401, which would have been Rock County? Why doesn't that apply here?
801.51 doesn't apply for four reasons, Justice Gableman. Number one, because the legislature afforded defendants in consumer credit cases a protection beyond
You said defendants, but you're assuming the defendant is a consumer. Why shouldn't it apply across the board to everyone?
I think it has to, and so did the legislature when it used the word defendant rather than consumer defendant. The statute is clear that it cuts both ways. We can't read the statute one way or another.
I want to direct your attention, Mr. Miller. I want to afford you the opportunity to tell why isn't 801.51, where it talks about any other statute designating proper venue, why doesn't that apply to the Wisconsin Consumer Act?
Because if 801.51 is applied, consumer defendants will lose a protection specifically afforded them by the Wisconsin Consumer Act, by the legislature when it made the venue provision jurisdictional.
But your argument is going back to what you responded to the Chief Justice when she asked about it, and you said, well, gee, that's not fair to consumers because they might not know they have to file within that timeline. Is that where you're going?
That's the first point.
Well, but let's talk about that first point. Don't we hold unrepresented individuals to the same legal standard as attorneys every day in every circuit court in the state if they're following the law?
We're talking about an interpretation of 421.401, how that should be interpreted and applied. And my point is that the legislature has stated a specific protection for consumer defendants, and that needs to be taken into consideration when we interpret 421.401. It also bears mentioning that the remedy is different. Under 801.51, defendant, when there is improper venue, files a motion for change of venue, and the circuit court can grant, potentially, that motion for change of venue. That's impossible under 421.401. When there's a venue defect under the Wisconsin Consumer Act in a consumer credit transaction, the court lacks jurisdiction other than to dismiss. Third reason, 421.401 is the more specific statute and therefore controls. It was revised by the legislature more recently than the general venue statutes. And finally, this court in Kett has already settled the issue that the general venue statutes do not apply to the Wisconsin Consumer Act venue statute. 801.50 sub 1 states that a judgment granted when venue is improper shall not affect the validity of the judgment. That flies in the face of what this court decided in Kett. This court in Kett stated 801.50 does not apply to 421.401.
Sentence is wrong.
I'm sorry?
Maybe that sentence is wrong.
Sentence in Kett?
Thank you, Kenny. The whole thing is wrong.
The opinion is
that. That's a loser either way you answer it.
Could I just have 1 minute to make some
comments?
Yes,
but then do it very short, because then we got rebuttal. Go ahead. Okay.
The bottom line, Your Honors, is that the Court of Appeals decision is not good law. Our opponents concede as much by arguing for a pleading waiver rule in their brief. The Court of Appeals did not apply a pleading waiver rule here. Instead, the Court of Appeals stated that we waived the venue defect at some unidentified point during the litigation prior to raising the objection. As a result, consumer and creditor defendants are at greater risk of being subjected to distant and inconvenient fora. The Court of Appeals decision must be reversed based on the following four reasons. One, it disregards the legislature's specific intent to protect defendants from such abuse. Two, it is contrary to the statutory language, which requires an express waiver. Three, it fails to recognize the jurisdictional nature of the defect. And four, it abrogates this court's decision in NICRA without any explanation. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel. Ivan Hannibal, representing Denise Brunton. So you have 30 minutes.
May it please the court, my name is Ivan Hannibal, and I represent the plaintiff appellant, Denise Brunton, in this action. Before I get into my main argument, I just wanted to make a couple clarifying statements. I believe when the court asked about some of the dates, I'm not sure if Mr. Miller got them all correct. The complaint in this case was filed in December of 2005, and I believe the statute of limitations would have passed then by December of 2006, if I'm correct. And they filed their motion for summary judgment in February of 2007. So just to clarify some of the dates.
It was after the statute of limitations.
Yes.
From my apparent year, right?
Well, if the acts finished in, say, December of 2005 when the complaint was filed, Your Honor, that would mean December of 2006, the statute of limitations would have passed.
Right.
So they waited a couple months later to raise that issue.
Mr. Hannibal, I appreciate very much you clarifying that. I had a reason for asking that question, and it goes to footnote 1 in the circuit court's decision, which would be on page A10 of Nouvelle's brief. You have a case, you filed a case in Dane County Circuit Court in December of 2005. But apparently, the defendants filed a case in Rock County Circuit Court in May of 2006. And according to what I see on A10 of the appendix, page A10, there was some discussion about whether the case had been properly filed in Dane County and a request for a stipulation that it had been properly filed or that there's no objection to it. And you didn't get that. Now, that was before the statute of limitations ran out. Isn't that right?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor.
Why didn't you refile in Rock County?
That's a good question, Your Honor. I didn't become a part of this case until well after that occurred, and I just don't know why the decision was made not to refile the case in Rock County.
But Mr. Archibald, he's your partner, is he?
Yes, he is, Your Honor, my co-counsel.
Right, but he knew, he's saying, look at the Kett case. Mr. Miller, look at the Kett case. It says it's jurisdictional, and maybe it should have been filed in Rock County. Will you stipulate that it's okay in Dane County? Isn't that basically the way it happened?
That's my understanding, Your Honor.
Okay, before the statute of limitations.
Yes, it's my understanding.
Don't you really, in order to win this case, place in jeopardy all of the consumers who would benefit by the language of the statute with a much broader period for a waiver?
I don't think we do at all, Your Honor. I think there's a couple safeguards built in. And if we look at the safeguard first of all, the defendant has to be found to have appeared and waived improper venue. And our argument, which I intend on going through, Your Honor, is that that occurs under the framework of 801.51, like Justice Gableman pointed out. If you look at 801.52, that allows courts to have a discretionary change of venue. We didn't raise it in our brief, but I think it's a very important statute here. For example, if you had a creditor, and I think Justice Abramson was right on this point, most of the time it's creditors suing consumers. If we had a creditor, for example, suing a Janesville resident up in Ashland, and say, for example, that the consumer, who's pro se, that seems to be one of Nouvelle's concerns about pro se consumers, if they just filed, say, wrote a letter to the court saying, well, I didn't do whatever the complaint alleges, and the court found that using the framework of 801.51, that the defendant basically waived their challenge to improper venue, all that does is give the court competency to proceed. The court could still use the defendant, consumer, could a week later write the court and say, well, Your Honor, I'm down here in Janesville. The truck that I bought is down here. This is where we signed the contract. We should really have this case down here. That just, you know, the consumer could still write the court and ask for a discretionary change of venue, and the court still has that authority under 801.52. So I don't see any negative benefits by this.
Couldn't the consumers have done that in the Kett case?
They could have, but they just decide. I mean, I don't know the reasoning as to why they didn't answer the complaints in that case. But I guess they could have if they wanted to. But they just let a default judgment be taken against them.
How do you reconcile the Kett case with what you're arguing here?
Well, I think Kett just applies to default judgments, Your Honor. Here we're talking about if a defendant appears in waves, and that's done by filing either an initial motion or an answer to a case. Kett clearly didn't do that. I think it's completely inapposite to here. I think on one hand, in Kett, you have a case where consumers didn't respond whatsoever to the complaints, and so they get a default judgment. And I think Kett makes clear that default judgment is invalid from the point of entry because there's no possibility that a defendant could have appeared and waived. I think, you know, default judgments happen probably thousands of times all over Wisconsin every day.
Counselor, I was interested in your response saying they waived by filing an answer. Now, the Court of Appeals was very loosey-goosey about when waiver occurred in this case. We may not be so loosey-goosey, or maybe we will. Whoever knows whether we'll find waiver or not. But if simply filing an answer constitutes waiver, then if I understand your argument, you're outside of Kett because you're no longer involved in a default situation. And you've given up your right as a consumer to object to the action up in Eau Claire when you live in Grant County, right?
Well, you've given up your objection in terms of the court having competency to proceed. You haven't given up your objection to ask the court to transfer venue under its discretionary powers.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Counsel, I need to clarify something that I heard when you were talking with Justice Prosser, but was the request that they would stipulate to a change in venue from Dane County to move it to Rock County, or was it a request to stipulate that Dane County was the correct county for venue purposes?
I'm sorry. I believe it was the former. I believe the stipulation was to change it, but I just don't know, Your Honor.
And Nouvelle said, we will not agree to change this to Rock County. Is that right?
That's my understanding, Your Honor, but I honestly don't have any personal knowledge of that.
Okay. I'm looking at the circuit court's decision, but then they waited until after the statute of limitations would have run, and then they said, oh, this really belongs in Rock County, even though a request was made in August to stipulate to a change to Rock County. Am I understanding that correctly?
That's the way I understand it, Your Honor. They didn't want to stipulate to it. Why, going back to Justice Prosser's question, why we didn't dismiss the case at that point and file it in Rock County, I can't speak to, but they knew at the least, I guess the latest, is by that point that venue wasn't proper. But again, it looks like months later, this was in August of 2006, and they waited until February of 07 to raise this issue.
So maybe it was a conscious, voluntary, intentional.
That's very...
failure to raise it in August.
Right, Your Honor. I don't want to assign any motivations to anything, but the statute of limitations, I think, would have passed after that point if they waited like they did in February. If they would have raised the issue there, then, well, I think...
So both parties knew by August 9 that venue was wrong. Both parties knew about the Kett case, which said it's jurisdictional.
Right, Your Honor. Well, I can't speak for Mr. Archibald or Mr. Bowers, who filed the case, in terms of their, you know, they knew what they knew about the Kett case. I know.
No, but in August, everybody knew.
They knew about Kett, but I think I can't speak to this from personal knowledge again, Your Honor. But I don't know if Mr. Archibald thought, well, he looked at it and said, well, the statute says appeared and waived, and he could have well thought, well, after his conversation with Mr. Miller here, said, well, maybe we don't need to switch it there because they've appeared and waived. And so that could easily have been the outcome on that, Your Honor.
Counsel, I want to take a look at the statute since this is a statutory construction case.
Thank you, Your Honor.
This is also a case that I think is exceedingly important, especially given the tough economic times that so many people are facing now, and that this purpose, in part, was to curtail any kind of potential abuses against consumers. So let's take a look at the statute.
Your Honor, I don't mean to interrupt you, but I do have a blow-up of the statute. May I put it on the easel?
Yes, you may. Counsel, do you have any objection? Okay, have you seen the statute? Okay. Okay. 421 sub 2 says, when it appears from the return of service of the summons or otherwise that the county in which the action is pending under sub 1 is not a proper place of trial for such action, unless the defendant appears and waives the improper venue, the court shall act as follows. A deals with transfer. B deals with dismissal if it's a credit, consumer credit transaction. The whole battle here seems to me to be whether what these words mean, unless the defendant appears and waives. And one side essentially argues it has to be an express waiver, and the other argues that waiver can be, for want of a better phrase, passive or constructive waiver. Am I correct in boiling it down to statutory fight on those words?
I think so. I also think the or otherwise,
or otherwise
is important too, Your Honor.
Okay. In fact, the word or otherwise maybe adds to my point. And my point is, I think that statute is capable of more than one interpretation. And if you want to throw in the word or otherwise, you can't find much more of a squishy word than or otherwise. So I think there's ambiguity in that portion of the statute. Do you agree or disagree?
I agree to a certain extent, Your Honor. May I approach the exhibit?
Certainly.
I think, Your Honor, if we look at the statute, the key parts, if we look at the or otherwise language in context here, it refers to return of the service of summons. And that, to me, is telling me that this is something that happens in the initial parts of a litigation. Other things that happen are filing an answer and filing an initial motion. But if that's not clear enough that the or otherwise refers to those kind of acts, I think we have other language here, and that's right here,
is not a proper place of trial. That language there is telling you, well, at a minimum, the decision of whether or not venue's going to be okay in this case, in a particular instance, is going to be decided before a trial. Not like Nouvel argues at any time in the circuit court. I mean, under Nouvel's theory, they could wait after trial to go ahead and make their objection. If their understanding of MCRA is correct.
My point is this. I think it's ambiguous. Do you agree or disagree? You agree in part?
I agree in part, Your Honor.
Is the word waive, appear and waive, is that ambiguous?
That is ambiguous also, Your Honor. There's no...
Okay, so let's interpret what it means. That's what we're supposed to do if it's ambiguous. And how do we interpret this particular provision? I'll tell you the way I think the framework is. And I sit here and listen to lots of words and I think, why isn't this somewhat easy? Look, the statute's ambiguous, so how do you interpret it? Interestingly, this statute tells you how you interpret the statute, doesn't it? Some statutes have clauses or sections that say, you shall interpret this way, and this is one of those statutes that does. Am I correct?
I think you are, Your Honor.
And what does that statute say? How should you interpret this statute? What does 421.102 state? It states, I'll answer because I've got it in front of me, that you have to interpret this statute to protect the consumers against unfair, deceptive, false, misleading, and unconscionable practices by the merchants. That's one of the ways you interpret the statute. Is that correct?
Correct.
And the Kett case tells us, look, you got to interpret it consistent with the purpose. And what does the Kett case say is the purpose of this statute? If you remember. If you don't remember, the Kett case says the purpose of the Wisconsin Consumer Act is to assist consumers, particularly those of limited means, in combating unfair business practices. Do you agree that's the purpose of this statute?
Most definitely, Your Honor.
Okay, so now we've got an ambiguous statute, and we're told by the statute and by case law, how do we interpret it? We interpret it in a way that fulfills the purpose to assist consumers, particularly those of limited means, in combating unfair business practices. And looking at the words appear and waive, show me how those words should be construed to best protect the consumers of limited means in combating unfair practices. Tell me why your interpretation is the better interpretation in advancing that purpose of protecting consumers.
Well, Your Honor, I don't think that necessarily our way is going to help consumers.
Then you're wrong, because the statute says that's what you're supposed to do.
It's going to help your client. Your client's a consumer.
Right, our client's a consumer, Your Honor. But I think
consumers generally.
Right, but I don't think it's going to hurt consumers either, Your Honor. And I think I agree with your assessment that the reasons behind the purposes behind 421, one of them is to help consumers. And but I also think that when something is ambiguous in the statute here, in this statute specifically, we have to look at 801.50, like Justice Gableman alluded to, specifically subsection 5M.
Not all of 801.50.
Not all of it, Your Honor, but definitely subsection 5M, where this section is, 421 is specifically referred to. In subsection 5M. I don't know if the legislature would have added subsection 5M, which regards consumer credit transactions, and put it in 801.50 if they didn't want it interpreted somehow in conjunction with 801.50 and 801.51. As the court will notice, consumer transactions isn't in. There's no reference to consumer transactions in 801.50, but consumer credit transactions. So that shows some sort of intent by the legislature to put consumer credit transactions under the house of 801.50, and then thus subject to the framework, the analysis of 801.51 for challenging improper venue.
Counsel, are you arguing that it was waiver when you asked, or your partner, asked Novell whether they stipulate to changing the venue from Dane to Rock County, and they said no? Is that waiver?
I think that's one way of wavering it, waiving it, Your Honor, but I think the proper analysis and one that this court should adopt is the framework in 801.51, especially sub 1, where it says a party has to basically challenge venue either in its initial motion or its responsive pleading. I mean, that's for two reasons, Your Honor. And that's because 801.51 talks about 801.50, and by definition, sub 5M fits in there. And then it also, as Justice Gableman pointed out, talks about other statutes designating proper venue. 421.401 is another statute designating proper venue. I think Nouvelle's problem, it lies with this section here, filing a motion for change of venue. They're saying, Nouvelle says, oh, wait a minute here, we can't use 801.51 because the remedy is different. 801.51 remedy is a change of venue. The remedy under 421.412B is to dismiss for lack of jurisdiction or competency.
So when are you saying they have to challenge venue?
In their answer or the first initial motion if they make one.
And how does that enhance the purpose behind the legislation? The statute says it has to be construed, if it's ambiguous, to advance the purpose. That's what the statute says. Let me give you an example. Let's say my cousin Todd is sued. Todd lives in Janesville, and he's sued by a company in Ashland. I think someone gave an example. And that's where they filed the complaint. And it's over $1,250. And Todd says, geez, I can't afford to get a lawyer. And that, as soon as I walk into the door, they're going to be charging me that much. So I'm going to represent myself. Now, clearly, in my mind, if this, let's say, company is doing this consistently, I don't care where the consumer lives, we're going to file it in good old Ashland. We're going to file it there because we know it's going to raise havoc with someone in Milwaukee who lives downtown or lives in Beloit or lives in Genosha. Yeah, they'll just pay it or give a default. They won't do anything. But Todd decides to fight it because he doesn't think he owes it. And so he sends a letter, dear judge, I don't owe this. Judge construes it as an answer. Scheduling order is set. You know, maybe a couple of interrogatories are sent by the company to Todd, and he tries to fill it out, and 6 months passes. Under that hypothetical, what's the rule of law that you would advance? And how does your rule of law protect the consumer?
Well, the first part of it, Your Honor, is I think the rule of law that I'm going to stick with my initial response is the challenge of the outline in 801.51, answer or initial motion. Now,
so Todd's out of luck.
If Todd decides to answer and the court construes it as an answer, it's going to be determined appeared in waiver. However, it still has it. Let me back up. If your cousin Todd decided not to answer at all, which happens many times, then the place that sued, the creditor that sued your cousin Todd, is going to be get a default judgment.
Todd's fighting this. He doesn't owe the money. He doesn't want to go to Ashland, but he's fighting it.
You're going to say that he's going to argue Kett, right?
No, I was going to say he probably wouldn't know about Kett, but if they did get a default judgment against him,
whether he argued it or not, if he knew about Kett, he would argue it under that circumstance, right?
Right, if he knew about Kett, then he either wouldn't answer.
Todd know about Kett?
No, I don't know. Okay.
I think this is as good a time as any to say that the former district attorney of Ashland County, Todd's going to get a fair trial.
I guess if he decides not to answer, and if we look at the Johnson case, as soon as a default judgment's entered, if he has to go, your cousin Todd has to go and retain a consumer attorney like myself and decides he wants to go after them because they got a default judgment against them in Ashland, and it was the wrong county, that's one option he can take. The other option is Like I mentioned, I think twice earlier, Your Honor, and that's, well, your cousin Todd can go right to court and go, well, gosh, I didn't know about this venue statute under 421.401, so, but I'm still, everything's kind of down here, Your Honor. Why not use your discretionary powers to at least bring the case down here? Even though you've got jurisdiction, you didn't dismiss it for lack of competency. He can still transfer it.
Kenny, if it's not, if it is a consumer credit transaction, under the words of the statute, can he transfer it?
I haven't seen any language that says it cannot be transferred, Your Honor.
I look at the statute 421.401, sub 2, sub A and B, and it says what the court should do. And A says, except as provided in sub B, if it appears that another county would be a proper place of trial, the court shall transfer the action to that county. Fair enough. Except as provided in paragraph B. So what does B say? If the action arises out of a consumer credit transaction, the court shall dismiss the action for lack of jurisdiction.
Right, but I think you're right, Your Honor, but I think one step that was missed is the appearance and waiver analysis. You don't get to subsection B until it's been decided whether or not the defendant's appeared and waived. That's how Nouvelle wants to analyze this as a competency issue. But that's actually putting the horse before the cart, or the cart before the horse, excuse me. Because that competency, and when I've heard of competency, I'm talking about subsection B, that doesn't come into play until the court's decided whether or not, the defendants appeared and waived the issue.
Counsel, 421.401.1, which sets the venue, it's all consumer-oriented, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
A, B, and C are all consumer-oriented. It seems to me that the appropriate interpretation is under 421.401.1a, where the consumer rides or resides or is personally served when the consumer is the defendant. In fact, maybe all of 421.401.1 is in favor of the customer, and therefore applies where the customer is the defendant, and that it doesn't apply where the customer is the plaintiff, and that the general rules apply for venue where the customer is the plaintiff.
I agree that...
That's your argument here.
I agree, Your Honor. I definitely think, the statute, like you know, refers to customer here. In several different instances, customers, consumers...
Consumer credit. In this case, if we go back to look at 2, subsection 2, when you look at proof of service, which is on the corporation, the corporation was served in Madison.
Okay, Your Honor.
And so if you looked at proof of service, you wouldn't know the venue was bad, because there's nothing here that says anything about the customer. But if you look at the complaint, paragraph 3 says, Brunton is a natural person residing in Beloit. So before otherwise here, the service of the summons, the return won't show you that there's a problem. But the or otherwise, the complaint does. So it's right on the face of all of this.
Right, Your Honor. And I think is a natural tendency, going back to Justice Bradley's worry, most people, when they get sued, and if they get sued in a distant forum, one of the first concerns is, well, I'm being sued in a distant forum. How do I deal with this? And so they raise that issue early in the process, and they try to figure out how I can challenge that if it can be challenged. And Nouvelle and any other consumer, since most of these cases apply to consumers, will hopefully raise that in their answer or initial motion. At least all Nouvelle had to do here And I'm not taking any of the culpability away from Ms. Broughton for us filing it in the wrong county to begin with. But ultimately, they'll have to do is say, well, let's put venue down, a challenge to venue as an affirmative defense. One line would have preserved their defense and raised the issue from the get-go. I got some of the questions from the court early on. Judicial resources is a big issue here. I mean, we're talking a year went by here after the complaint was filed, more than a year. Discovery's going on, depositions, interrogatories back and forth. If this court adopts Nouvelle's framework for analysis, letting a competency or challenge to venue to happen at any time, we're opening up Pandora's box here, I think, in saying that, well, circuit courts are going to be dealing with issues, for up to a year, at a minimum 1 year, if the defendant is sly enough, and I'm not saying this applies to Nouvelle, to wait until the statute of limitations passes before raising the defense of improper venue.
Well, Mr. Hannibal, you were asked earlier, a few minutes ago, about whether you thought the statute had different results depending on who was the plaintiff and who was the defendant. I did not understand that to be your argument at all. In fact, in direct response to one of my questions, you said you were arguing for an across-the-board application of the statute, which apparently would be in conformity with 421-401 subsection 1, which states the venue for a claim arising out of a consumer transaction or a consumer credit transaction is the county, and then it goes on to list the different factors. Now, I understand your argument to be that applies across the board, no matter who is in the plaintiff's part of the caption and who is in the defendant's part of the caption. True?
That's correct, Your Honor.
All right. And then once the answer or the affirmative defense or what's interpreted as the affirmative defense is filed, and the time under 851 goes by to challenge the venue, then it's up to the court's discretionary decision-making process, according to your argument, as to whether to transfer venue back to some other county.
Right, Your Honor.
And just as equally as transferring it under that discretionary matter, the good Judge Eaton in Ashland County could say to Todd, hey, you litigated this for a year. You've been answering, you've been appearing, you've been filing things. I think Ashland County is the right place in this circumstance. True?
I think that's true, Your Honor.
How can they do that when the statute says that it's in the wrong jurisdiction and has to be dismissed?
Are you talking about transfer, Your Honor?
Well, they can transfer to the right place, but if the court doesn't transfer to the right place, the court shall dismiss the action for lack of jurisdiction.
Well, I think it goes back to the whether or not they, it's kind of circular, Your Honor. I think my contention would be that goes back to the appears and waivers and whether the defendant did that. If they
I understand that. You're not in two at all.
I'm sorry?
You're only in the first part of two.
Oh, right. I'm sorry. But to me, the whether the defendant appears and waives here, we don't reach sub 2B. I mean, if they file their answer, then they appeared and waived, so then 2B, wouldn't...
But doesn't have discretion to keep it in Ashland County if it's the wrong county. Unless the defendant appeared
and waived. Yeah, if the defendant appeared and waived, the court would have discretion. I mean, whether or not the court wants to do that, I...
So, under Nouvelle's logic, if a defendant doesn't appear, default judgment enters, and then they later find out about that, and then poor Todd says, gee, I didn't know that happened, and writes the court and says, I'd like you to reopen this, and by the way, you don't have jurisdiction. Under sub B, does the court have to dismiss the action? Even though you might have had judgment enter, and even though perhaps the statute of limitations has passed, if Todd decides, gee, it's been a while, and I want to reopen this, and judge, the good reason for reopening it is you didn't have jurisdiction.
Well, I don't think so, Your Honor. If in the original underlying action they filed an answer or an initial motion...
No, default judgment.
Oh, default judgment. Then I think what we have here is kept. Then Cousin Todd goes and goes after the creditor because they got a default judgment in an improper county. So that's, I think, if I understand what you're saying correct, Your Honor, it's basically kept.
And it shall dismiss.
Right, and it should reopen it and then dismiss it, and then they subject themselves. I think the one thing, getting to Justice Bradley's concern, if creditors are going to do this and try and if we use the 8-1 framework and use it against consumers, they're going to risk, whenever they get default judgments, subjecting themselves to you know, Kett and its sister case, Johnson. And I don't know too many creditors that want to open that up. I mean, I guess they'd be lying at consumers to be completely naive about those cases, and many may be, but they'd be opening themselves up to some potential liability.
Well, counsel, is there anything about the Court of Appeals decision you don't like?
Yes, Your Honor, and that is, I do agree with Nouvelle in this particular area, and that's the Court of Appeals kind of left it open as to when Nouvelle appeared and waived its objection, and I don't particularly like that. I mean, I like the outcome, of course, but the reasoning, I think, if we just go back to...
When do you think they appeared when they filed an answer.
Right, and I believe that was February 2nd of 2016.
So when did they waive?
February 3rd of 2006.
Under 801.51
sub 2.
Okay,
sub
got
eight,
it.
2A.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Stewart?
Thank you, Chief Justice Abramson. May it please the court. My name is Walter Stewart. I represent Nouvelle Credit Corporation. We are here because the plaintiff filed a consumer credit transaction in the wrong county. The plaintiff's position is that the defendant has a duty to cure the defect, and she relies upon the general venue statute to address improper venue for what the defendant must do and when it must be done. The defendant urges you to reject this argument. We believe reliance on the general venue statute is misplaced, as that statute is not applicable to actions based on consumer credit transactions. I would like to address the issue that the court has been discussing early on in Ms. Button's argument, that there was a waiver by participating in the litigation. And the plaintiff essentially asked the court to adopt the result of the Court of Appeals. We feel that the result of the Court of Appeals is not supported by any case law or by any statute. There's nothing in the decision that states what is the basis for the holding. But more importantly, we would ask the court to consider what actually happened in this case. First is that the plaintiff filed in the wrong county. Second, the plaintiff knew she had filed in the wrong county. Three, plaintiff's counsel asked defense counsel whether it would stipulate to a change in venue, even though the remedy is not available for consumer credit transactions. Number four, the plaintiff failed to bring the defect to the attention of the trial court and to ask Judge Schwartz to determine whether the defendant would waive improper venue. Five, plaintiff failed to voluntarily dismiss the Dane County action and then refile in a timely manner in Rock County. And then six, plaintiff chose to proceed with the Dane County action under the risk of dismissal, and it knew about this risk because it knew the Kett case. The defendant claims that it cannot be stopped from choosing to exercise one of its rights available under the Wisconsin Consumer Act to refuse to waive improper venue and to ask the trial court to dismiss for lack of jurisdiction.
Is there any way of waiving other than, what is a waiver in your opinion? Does it have to be an express on the record waiver by the defendant?
Yes, Your Honor, I would say that it does. And the reason I say that is because the language of the statute that says to appear and waive. It's not uncommon, for example, for a lawyer to appear in a case, provide a notice of appearance, and provide no further pleadings. The lawyer's just asking the other side and to the court to keep us informed as to what is happening here.
Okay, that's why you have waivers. So when does it waive? When they file the answer?
We believe that waiver is not required to state your affirmative defense when you file the answer, and indeed there is no pleading waiver rule where the defect is competence.
So you can go right through getting a trial court judgment?
And that would be possible for the protection of the defendant in most cases.
And then after the defendant loses, here, Novell loses, then you can seek reconsideration on the ground that there was wrong venue? You think that's okay?
Yes, under NICRA, all we know is we have to bring it before the attention of the trial court.
And then if the trial court says no, not going to open it up on the ground of the wrong venue, then you go up to the Court of Appeals and you would say, hey, we never waived. We brought it to the trial court.
Possibly. That's a scenario how that case might possibly unfold, yes.
If the Court of Appeals held against you, you'd come up here.
Well, hopefully the decision in this case will allow us to avoid that.
But, I mean, that's your argument.
Yes.
In effect.
Yes. The plaintiff
Mr. Stewart, Mr. Stewart,
yes.
The word sandbag was used earlier in the discussion here. Does the defendant have some duty not to sandbag a party that has filed in the wrong county?
We believe that the defendant does not have a duty to cure the plaintiff's defects. That case has a defect when it's filed in the wrong county. And the statute does not impose upon the defendant the duty to cure the problem. The defendant, in some cases, might choose to provide an affirmative waiver, or the defendant might choose to be silent. But the problem is with the plaintiff that is proceeding with a case that has a competency issue. The plaintiff contends that the defendant should be required to challenge venue at the outset of litigation so that the defendant doesn't sit on the venue objection for strategic advantage. We would ask the court to consider the circumstances in Kett where the consumer defendants suffered entry of invalid default judgments and then the seizure of their motor vehicles before they challenged the judgments and alleged illegal debt collection practices. Did the defendants in Kett have a strategic advantage, or were they exercising the right to have their cases heard in the correct forum, just as the Wisconsin Consumer Act so requires? We believe Section 421.401.2b does not require the defendant to do anything.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, Mr. Stewart, Mr. Miller, and Mr. Hannibal for your arguments on this consumer credit case. Decision will be in due time. That ends the hearing on 07-AP-1253, Denise Brunton versus Novell Credit Corporation. We will take a few moments in recess so that